On this week's 51%, we meet a woman making her directorial debut with a film about her sister's suicide.
This is a sea change in my life. The idea that I could actually be the film director.
And hear about a program to encourage young women to enter STEM-related fields. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Hope Litoff is a veteran film editor. Now her directorial debut is with a documentary called 32 Pills, My Sister's Suicide. The film is her search for answers. She wanted to know more about her older sister's struggle with mental illness and why New York City-based artist Ruth Litoff committed suicide in 2008. The documentary has been screened at a number of film festivals and premieres on HBO December 7th. I caught up with Hope Litoff at the film screening at the Woodstock Film Festival at a theater in Rhinebeck, New York. We spoke just after she'd held a Q&A with the audience, during which she said she thought the film would be cathartic for her, but it wasn't. So I asked her if she were glad she made the film.
Although the process of making the film was very difficult, I'm glad I made it. I feel that I was going to have a difficult time no matter what. I was going to have to face the fact that my sister was dead and really grieve her in a way that I did not allow myself to do for years. I mean, I just kept being the good girl, which was my role in the family. I kept suppressing my feelings, and I was going to go down the drain no matter what. So I almost feel lucky that if I was going to go down the drain no matter what, that I have this sort of beautiful work of art, and I'm not taking credit for it being a work of art. My team made it a work of art that I can now share with people and hopefully help them. And this is the part that's the most healing for me. So I feel like I feel less alone when people say thank you. I have a similar story, and I hope and I think they feel less alone too, and that's really the incredible healing part.
One of the things that stood out for me in the film is you're in the film, you're 90% of the film, but we don't know anything about you other than your relationship with your sister, and that's a very interesting way to be in the film for that amount of time, other than your struggles with addiction. That's all we really know. So unless I've read a bit about you and I know a bit about you, you don't know. And so was it a very conscious decision to not take the screen away from her in a sense?
I wish I were in the film less. My being in the film so much came very much out of sharing the film with my executive producers, other filmmakers, people who I trusted their opinions, and they would say, keep more of you in, keep more of you in. And I felt really embarrassed. It was Ruth that always wanted to be in front of the camera and be the star, and my life was very comfortable in a dark editing room by myself. And that's where I'm most comfortable. And it's interesting that you point out that I'm really only understood in relationship to my sister. And I think that's something that I still struggle with in my own personal therapy. She was an incredibly powerful, magnetic, charismatic person. And she... For example, if I played Monopoly with her and my mother, she would roll the dice for all of us and move all of the pieces. She was a very domineering, very powerful person, and I was her assistant. And I think in the conclusion of the film, I say she wanted to be part of me. And that was always sort of something, a pull for me, trying to be my own person, but feeling pulled back into her. And I said, she is. She's inside me, and I am comfortable with that. I don't feel overwhelmed by her. Of course she's a part of me. So you noticing that I define myself by her is actually something very astute and not even something that I consciously thought of. But that is very true of my personality. I do often define myself by my sister.
I mean, there was something you said in the film that was, I don't want the responsibility. I'm the last living, you know, the living records. I don't want the responsibility of throwing things out. And at the toward the beginning of the film, I forget who it was. It says, why are you keeping, don't throw it out. For a very different reason, I understand what that means. Then you don't want the responsibility of what's left. If you are the chosen person, I mean, is that something that you are just always going to keep in storage until your last day?
I hope that I don't keep it in storage until my last day. Everything's in that storage room. I have her old sneakers. Like, those don't need to be in there. Her clothing should go to Goodwill and should be put to use. But more importantly, her art should be out in the world and being admired. And I'm just really struggling with parting with it, because to me, it feels like I'm parting with her. And sometimes stuff is just stuff, but this stuff is really meaningful to me.
So it's your decision. I mean, you'll do what you need to do.
She wrote many notes, and she was very specific that she wanted her friends to have the artwork. And I actually made a fake ending to the film where I went around the city handing the artwork to her friends, and then when the camera cut, I took the artwork back. And it was sort of a horrible decision. It was like not documentary filmmaking. It was some desire to give an audience a happy ending, and then it was just so wrong and so not what happened, and we didn't use any of that footage.
Interesting. Here was your directorial debut. You just said, I'm most comfortable in a dark editing room by myself. And now you're on screen, and it's you're directing in a field where not a lot of women are doing, not enough women are doing it. I mean, is there some empowerment in that regard?
Absolutely. I feel, I don't want to be in another movie, but I would definitely love to continue telling stories and continue being a director. And for me, this is a change. This is a sea change in my life. The idea that I could actually be the film director, and film editing, I was very well trained for by my sister, because you're basically solving the problems of the director. And I love that. It feels great. And you're kind of a hero. You know, it's a very comfortable position for me to sort it out. And I'm lucky enough that I work with a lot of women directors. I am far enough in my editing career now that I get to choose who I work with, and that's who I choose to work with. It's the most rewarding relationship for me. And a lot of the grants that I won were not only money. What was more important was many of them were to empower women and empower women filmmakers. And I feel like a lot of what I learned from those, they would call them labs, and we would meet and we would talk about what does it mean to be a woman in the film world and to feel empowered and to learn how to ask for money and to not feel shy about it and to be powerful and not feel like you're being overbearing or a bitch or, you know, not the demure girl that you were taught to be when you were growing up. And I would like to take what I learned and continue on.
There's so much going on in this film, you know, but it, in the end, it's just a deeply personal portrait. It's that's what it is. But yet there's suicide, there's mental illness, there's the age in which your sister was ill, what was available research-wise, what, you know, the diagnosis. I'm sure you wrestle with that probably daily. What if it were today, if it was this doctor, if it, you know. So it's just, you're also a product of the times. You know, your sister is a product of the times. But in this is a real big message, intended or not, about mental illness and suicide prevention. Or maybe not. Maybe you're going to tell me there isn't. Is there something you want anybody to walk away with on any of those two subjects?
Well, it is true that my sister was diagnosed at a very early time. I think that her first suicide attempt, I'm confident that her first suicide attempt was pre-Prozac. So there really wasn't even the kind of medication out that we have now. And I do sometimes worry that if a young person who's maybe just been diagnosed with some sort of mental illness, I don't want them to ever feel that it's a death sentence. Because my sister ultimately does die. I don't want it to feel like a hopeless situation because there are so many more opportunities and medications and treatments now that my sister didn't have access to. But it's an interesting time because I feel like I'm just one in the chain of making these kind of movies. There are other women directors that I've looked at their documentaries about suicide, and I feel like they were allowed to tell just so much about it. And then maybe the one that was made 5 years after that one told a little bit more, and I was able to be maybe that much more honest. And I hope that there's another film that can really be honest about what it's like having a borderline sister and not feel the pressure to have a happy ending or a resolution. Sometimes I feel like there's a tyranny of the narrative where if there isn't a winner of the spelling bee, audiences don't want to watch it. So I would love for the next person to make the better film. And I just am happy to be part of a link in the chain of where it's all going.
Well, I wanted to know how you felt about, or did you, you know, you have carte blanche. I'm drinking, I'm going to take these pills. I mean, there were some moments in there that were, not many people would have the guts to show themselves like that. Did you care? I mean, did you realize, because at some points, you know, you're not sober in this film.
So
when you are and you see this, like, do you even care about that?
I don't care. I've always been very open and honest about my sobriety. It's never been something when someone said to me, why aren't you drinking at a party, that I would say something like, I'm allergic, or I'm on antibiotics, or, you know, I would just say, I'm sober, I can't drink. And I really wanted to be as honest as I could and show what it's like. And, you know, in the Q&A, you learn that it took me much longer to get sober. And in 85 minutes, you can't tell everything. But I just sort of feel like, show me the person that doesn't have a secret. And I don't know, I'll set off fireworks. There's nobody who doesn't struggle with something. And if I can share my struggle and help other people feel better, I'm totally okay with that.
I'm trying to think if there's a man, you know, that I've seen do similar. That's not a fiction film.
I don't think so. I mean, you know a filmmaker like Judith Helfand made A Healthy Baby Girl years ago, and it was about the fact that her mother took a medication that then caused the daughters of these women to then have to have hysterectomies. And they were told that her film was called A Healthy Baby Girl. She invites you into the gynecologist's office. I mean, she's incredibly brave. She shows you that she has a catheter and she's carrying around a shopping bag full of urine. And she's incredible. She's one of my idols of filmmaking. And I was lucky enough to actually assist on a film that she made. And that's where I met my cinematographer, Dan Gold, who's also amazing. And I feel like we need women like that. And women are the ones that are maybe more in touch with their feelings, and men are getting there. But opening up yourself and being vulnerable is not necessarily something men are as comfortable with.
That was Hope Liddoff talking about her documentary, 32 Pills, My Sister's Suicide. It is the veteran film editor's directorial debut. Just a note, Liddoff started drinking again while making the film after 16 years of sobriety. She is sober again today. Making the film also led Hope Liddoff to realize her sister's dream and exhibit her sister's photographs in Bellevue Hospital, where Ruth Liddoff spent a lot of time. 32 Pills, My Sister's Suicide, premieres on HBO December 7th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Women make up half of the nation's college-educated workforce, but that's not the case in STEM fields. In computer science, physical science, mathematics, and engineering fields, women are less than one-third of all workers. The gap has inspired programs like Eureka, which encourages young women to go into STEM-related fields. 51%'s J.D. Allen reports.
Massachusetts State Representative Tricia Farley Bouvier, a Pittsfield Democrat, says, too many people see Rosie the Riveter as a relic.
War was going on, and so even, gasp, married women were working as scientists in the early 1940s. And you know, they were capable scientists that contributed to economic development and to the war effort, and they were very much needed. And after the war, when the men came home, the men needed the jobs. And so the women were told they had to go home. And then we had this idea that women weren't really cut out for math and for science. And somehow that got into our collective psyche.
The struggle, Farley Bouvier says, is changing that culture and closing the gender gap in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics-related fields. The National Girls Inc. Eureka program hopes to do just that, and now it's in Berkshire County. The five-year program guides middle school girls into the STEM career path up until college. The program is being aimed at helping low-income people, a group the Girls Inc. location at the Gladys Allen Brigham Community Center in Pittsfield already serves.
59% of our girls identify as a minority. 44% came from a household whose annual income is less than $25,000 a year. 40% of our girls live with single parents, and a shocking 12% live with neither parent.
Community Center CEO Kelly Marion says Eureka will foster opportunities, resources, and support to young girls.
Our goal is to add new cohorts, eventually having 100 girls participating annually in a five-year cycle.
The program costs $50,000 a year. Half of the funds already covered by a match grant from Avangrid Foundation and its subsidiary Berkshire Gas. During the first 2 years, students will go to summer camps at partner institutions, Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts and Berkshire Community College. There, they'll be exposed to STEM-related experiments and programs, as well as leadership and sports. In partnership with the Berkshire County Regional Employment Board, sophomore and junior girls will be given paid internships with local companies before their final year of college prep. BCC Dean of Academic Affairs, Business, Science, Mathematics, and Technology Division, Charles Kaminsky, says programs like this can broaden girls' horizons.
That catalyst that brings them to this realization that they can really pursue a field in STEM that they want to do and have a passion for, not just what they feel is expected of them based on their gender.
MCLA Associate Dean for Academic Affairs Adrian Wooters says she hears girls say,
I don't see myself there. That's what guys do. And that was certainly my image when I was a kid.
Wooters, now a physicist, is a member of the Berkshire STEM Pipeline, a consortium between area colleges, school districts, and nonprofits to encourage students to go into STEM fields. Annie Heitman is the Northeast Regional Director at Girls Inc., which has 1,400 locations across the U.S. and Canada. Heitman says Eureka was created in 1987 at Brooklyn College and was piloted around the country at 5 locations in 1992 with funds from the National Science Foundation.
And it was designed to help girls develop leadership and career skills and was targeted to girls of color living in the inner city, many of whom were economically disadvantaged.
It was further expanded in 2010 by the Clinton Global Initiative. The location in the Berkshires is the 19th Girls Inc. affiliate to run Eureka. It's already in Holyoke, Worcester, Albany, and Schenectady. Marion says the Pittsfield program will start next year with 20 girls.
No girl will be charged a fee, so the cost burden to a girl, to their family, is removed, making participation a reality.
Until then, Girls Inc. is in search for its first Eurekans. For 51%, I'm J.D. Allen.
Research shows that when someone goes to prison, the health of that person's family members can suffer. Mothers, spouses, and even neighbors report more health problems than do those whose loved ones walk free. While a bus service in Indianapolis helps families stay connected, reporter Emily Foreman from Side Effects has the story.
Janice McLean climbs on the bus at a stop downtown. She takes a seat among a dozen or so other women, all women on their way to visit children, spouses, and fiancés in prison.
Hi.
Hi.
It's so nice to meet you.
Okay, we're going to pray. Father, we honor you.
Janice has been riding this bus for over 10 years to visit her 35-year-old son, Edward Hobson.
They call him Pearl. He don't really like to be called Edward.
She calls Pearl her knee baby, remembering him glued to her knee when he was just as tall. Pearl went to prison 16 years ago for murder. Janice struggled to stay in contact, and her health suffered.
I mean, I passed out the day of his trial. I mean, I just passed out on the floor and have been sick ever since then.
So the one health thing for the people in the prison is the importance of the touch and the hug.
Since 1998, Cecilia Whitfield has given thousands of families rides to prisons across Indiana. Cecilia and their driver, Linda, talk about the importance of the touch a lot.
Linda has sent me a thing over the Facebook to talk about just 10 seconds hug helps the memory, helps to do healing.
It all started while visiting her son in prison. On those trips, she met many families needing rides. Several years later, she bought a bus on layaway and painted it purple and white. She named her prison ministry after her mom's favorite saying, use what you got. Janice used to drive 6 hours round trip to see Pearl. The first time, the prison turned her away, and she cried for hours until they let her in. Pearl isn't the first child Janice lost. Her two oldest sons died. One got hit by a car. Another was shot. So when Pearl left, Janice's blood pressure skyrocketed, resulting in multiple trips to the ER.
And the depression just set in where basically I just didn't care. You know, I wasn't taking my medication like I was supposed to. I wasn't doing anything like I was supposed to.
Then Janice got really sick. First, a major blood vessel ruptured. 3 days later, she had a stroke. She lost her ability to speak, read, and write. Basically, every way of communicating with Pearl.
And the only highlight of my life, basically, was going to see him and knowing that I can't see him. Just, I couldn't handle it.
Her primary care physician wrote the prison. Janice's recovery depends on seeing her son. And it worked. The prison moved Pearl 20 minutes away, a more manageable distance for Janice to ride. And her speech gradually returned.
I'll need my ID.
Now she rides with Cecilia, who says Janice isn't alone. Among the families she's worked with, often stress and anxiety lead to bigger health issues. At the prison, Janice waits in her socks holding a styrofoam bowl full of quarters for a vending machine lunch. Women ahead of her in line struggle to get through the metal detector. Is there underwire in your bra, a guard asks. 2 hours later, Janice returns to the bus with a photo. Pearl has his arm wrapped around Janice. Her beige shirt matches his beige uniform.
Any anxiety I may have had yesterday or last week or whatever, all of that is just gone.
Since her speech returned, they talk on the phone too. But seeing him helps her know he's okay.
I've seen my baby, you know.
For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Emily Foreman.
This story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a reporting collaborative focused on public health. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1479.